Thank you, Selena. I will begin this second week by talking about extended mind and cognition. Let me share my screen and get started. The title of today's lecture is Extended Cognition and the Boundaries of the Mind. I'm going to begin by differentiating between different versions of the hypothesis of extended cognition and extended mind. This can be perhaps a little bit tedious, but it's important to understand what it is we're arguing about or what theses we're exploring. Sometimes the dialectic gets a little confused, which considerations are meant to support what theses exactly. And I'll say more. I think you get a better sense of what it is I'm concerned about as I work through some of these. So let's start with the hypothesis of extended cognition. Sometimes it seems as if philosophers and cognitive scientists are talking about a merely modal thesis. This is especially true of philosophers, where modality has to do with possibility and necessity. So sometimes there's a merely modal idea that it's possible for human cognition to appear at least partly beyond the boundary of the human organism. That my thoughts or my cognitive processes might be, you know, possibly outside of my skin. This then is sometimes motivated by very far-fetched thought experiments involving hypothetical aliens and Martians, or asking, what if I were a spider? You know, kind of very fanciful questions, which seem pretty far removed from cognitive science, for example. Trouble, there we go. And then there's a what you might call the bare thesis, the bare actuality thesis. It's that some human cognition literally comprises elements beyond the boundary of the human organism, beyond the boundary of skin and skull. And on that view, perhaps it's somewhat rare for human cognition to include things beyond the boundary of the skin, but it's at least occasionally it happens. It's there are some cases. Increasing in strength a bit, you get a more robust thesis, which says that a significant number or proportion of human cognitive states and processes appear at least partly beyond the boundary of the human organism. Perhaps my cognition is almost entirely within my skin and skull. Most of my problem solving, everything I'm doing right now, for example, all of the cognitive portions are within my organism. But it might be that a significant amount of the time, maybe anytime I use one of these, it's my smartphone, my cognition includes that external device. That would be a pretty substantial amount of time since I use my smartphone pretty regularly. An even more robust version is that such a significant number, proportion, and variety of human cognitive states and processes appear at least partly beyond the boundary of the human organism, that our recognition of them creates a paradigm shift or a revolution in cognitive science. This is the thesis I'm most interested in. This idea that you know, there is an enormous shift underway in cognitive science. That was the language that was commonly in the air in the 90s and on into the new millennium. And this is, you know, it's a worthwhile question whether, you know, cognitive science is merely changing in small ways, or whether it's going to change root and branch, or has changed root and branch, and how it's connected to this idea of extended cognition. And this is will be a recurring theme in the lecture. Okay. Now, often one hears about the extended mind. There's a famous article by Andy Clark and David Chalmers, simply called The Extended Mind, which has been cited tens of thousands of times, I think, by now. This came out in 1998, and it used a mixture of examples, some to do with extended cognition, kind of from cognitive science, and some more oriented more toward common sense. So I want to distinguish between a discussion of the mind in that latter sense, to do with common sense, and extended cognition. So there could be four versions of this. There would be three versions of this. The first two would parallel the first two versions of Heck, the modal and the Bayer thesis. It's possible that some, or in fact, some human mental states, such as beliefs, desires, hopes, and fears, appear beyond the boundary of the human organism, that is, beyond the boundary of skin and skull. Or a more robust thesis would say, a significant number or proportion of human mental states and processes appear at least partly beyond the boundary of the human organism. There isn't a parallel to the fourth one. Remember, the fourth thesis concerning cognition has to do with cognitive science. And if we're separating mind from cognition as a scientific domain, then there won't be a question about scientific revolution. Paradigm shift. And I should say this is a, there is something important in this more robust thesis. It is worth thinking about the extent of this significance, or the extent of the number or proportion of human mental states. Clark and Chalmers end their article, their famous article, The Extended Mind, by talking about how we as human beings are more deeply creatures of the world, or you know, we're finding out something really deep about who we are, they claim. So they want a pretty robust thesis of extended mind, I think. Now, I've remarked already a bit on the difference between mind and cognition, but let me make the gist of those remarks explicit. The mind is more commonly associated with an everyday non-scientific understanding of human thought and consciousness, reflecting the commitments of what is sometimes called folk psychology or common sense psychology. In contrast, cognition is a scientific property, kind, or process. Talk of the sciences of the mind is, for present purposes, to abandon folk psychological perspective and enter the territory of cognitive science. So if we are to treat mind and cognition differently, mind is the pre-scientific domain. So sometimes folks will talk about the sciences of the mind, but we should, for my purposes anyway, I will understand that language really to be the science of cognition. And if we focus on mind in particular, we're back into this, you know, non-scientific domain of kind of armchair theorizing or speaking in a way that's just informed by common sense. But all that, you know, said about the differences between the two, the similarity between the explananda of cognitive science and folk psychological explanation, the similarity being forms of intelligent behavior, we should expect there to be some connection between mind and cognition. So even the idea is that even by focusing explicitly on cognition, we may learn something, at least indirectly, about the mind. At the very least, we might expect that wherever mental states and processes occur, cognitive states or processes must be. Thus, if cognition does not extend into the environment, mind does not either. The idea that is that whatever mental processes the average person is talking about, independent of science, those things must be supported by cognitive processing. They can't just sort of appear, you know, free form, or, you know, sort of unsupported by some underlying physical, computational, mechanistic process. And so cognition, at least if we reach a negative conclusion that there is no cognition in a certain area, out in the environment or in the physical body beyond the brain or what have you, if there's no cognition somewhere, then we could sort of reason backwards and say, oh, well, I guess there's no mind there either. But that connection is somewhat tenuous, and we can return to it if we like. My primary concern is with the philosophy of cognitive science. So why should we take the hypothesis of extended cognition seriously? What are the arguments in support of it? And then we'll ask what concerns we might have about those arguments. Well, it seems clear that cognition is highly interactive. External structures, properties, objects, events clearly contribute in some important way to the production of intelligent behavior. That's a reasonable starting place. Consider Clark and Chalmers, I'll call them CNC from now on, example of playing Scrabble. In this multiplayer board game, each player has 7 individual letter tiles and must assemble words from them in the style of a crossword puzzle, building upon words already played. Sometimes it's difficult to see what words one's letters might make. It helps to rearrange the tiles as one looks at them. It seems to make new possibilities appear. And here we have a graphic. So Scrabble involves the creation of a kind of crossword on top of a game board using a selection of letters. You can see the person on the left has just taken many of the letters from their rack. That rack is that wooden kind of slat on the bottom left. They've taken 4 of their letters and are playing them. Kanat, looks like, is the word. And the person on the right has their hand on their letters. They have their 7 letters in their rack. It will be their turn next, and they will have to figure out how to make a new word. They've got a very nice one there right now, rogue, all lined up. And maybe they arrived at that by reshuffling the letters. Maybe the person hadn't been able to see rogue at first. Their letters were E, G, D, O, R, you know, or in a different order. And the possibility of playing rogue didn't jump out at them. Now, they may in fact be in trouble because there might not be a place to put that right now, but you get the idea. The problem solving process itself involves the use of external materials. That's what's so important to Clark and Chalmers. They use a term at one point that comes out of the work of David Kirsch on gameplay, who talks about epistemic actions. Many of our actions are meant to lead us toward a goal, say to get us across the room, or to, in this case, put the word down onto the game board. But there's a prior process that it doesn't involve, say, actions that move us toward the goal. It involves actions that are part of the kind of plan for what to do to move toward the goal. In this case, it's part of the problem-solving process to figure out which word to put down. That one shuffles one's letters around, so it interacts with the letters on the rack where the letters are held. And this inspires what's sometimes thought of as a human organism anchored functionalist argument for Het. And the idea of an anchor is that we're using what happens in the human organism, what actually happens, as a kind of reference point. And you'll see as things develop what I have in mind there. So the functional role of the process of rearranging one's tiles is similar to the role played by certain neural goings on or processes of visual imagining that occur inside the organism when searching for ways to combine letters into words. So this comparison is very important to Clark and Chalmers. Think about what you do inside the organism if you're solving the problem. So you aren't allowed to touch your rack. You merely have to look at the letters and then try to imagine what the possible combinations would be. That process, they say, is already recognized as cognitive. So then let's make a comparison to the external one. So it's widely agreed that those internal states and processes are cognitive. They have that status. That's uncontroversial. And then add the premise that if two states or processes play the same functional role in the production of intelligent behavior, they have the same status. Either they're both cognitive or not. Put all that together and you get the result that the external states in question are cognitive. The internal ones are clearly cognitive. The external ones play the same role as the internal ones. So the external ones must be cognitive. It is part of your cognitive process to rearrange the tiles on the Scrabble rack. Now, assuming this is a widespread phenomenon, all four versions of Heck are true. So it's been part of Andy Clark's research program for some time to try to identify lots of examples along these lines, interactive examples that might qualify. So just give you a little bit more flavor of the kind of thing he has in mind. One sort of example involves an artist's sketch pad. When an artist sketches, the artist does not need to have in his or her mind a fully fleshed out image of what the artist will produce. Instead, often what artists will do is they'll sketch a little bit on the pad, and then their result will influence their further internal process, which then will produce some further sketching, which then will influence their internal process more. There's a feedback loop. And that is, it's the kind of thing that impresses Clark. On a very different kind of example, he thinks of cases where the external world plays something more like the role of a central executive in a traditional computational architecture, like the thing that has instructions in it or a program loaded into it. He says, imagine a child learning to tie their shoes. Often in these early stages, the child will say the instructions out loud. Take the right string, put it over the left string, loop underneath the left string. The words that they verbalize seem to go out in the world and from an external standpoint, play a kind of control role, the role of a command. That's another, a different kind of feedback loop. So Clark thinks, back to the slide, that this is a widespread phenomenon, in which case we get it all the way up to the strongest version of Heck, according to which it involves a revolution or a paradigm shift in cognitive science. Now let's think about a more liberal approach. We were talking about a human anchored kind of argument for Heck, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but Clark and Chalmers want to expand possibility here. And they appeal to something that's come to be called the parity principle. And I will quote them directly. If, as we confront some task, a part of the world functions as a process which, were it done in the head, we would have no hesitation in recognizing as part of the cognitive process, then that part of the world is, so we claim, part of the cognitive process. That is when it's external. This is a quotation from the paper I've been mentioning, The Extended Mind, which appeared in Analysis in 1998 and really got much of the discussion going, even though there was earlier work that had been published by such people as, say, Rob Wilson. And Andy Clark himself, to be fair. Okay, so this is a more liberal approach because it doesn't require anchoring. All that matters is that we would consider the external state or process in question to be cognitive if it were to appear inside the organism, regardless of whether something of this sort actually appears inside organisms. We're asking a more hypothetical question. You see an external state and you ask whether, if it were inside humans, we would consider it cognitive. And if the answer is yes, then the state or process is cognitive even when it's external. And part of what Clark is been on about in this regard is what he calls bio-chauvinism, a kind of chauvinism toward the organism and its biological materials. And so sometimes he says he wants to create a veil of metabolic ignorance, as if sort of say, let's just pretend you don't know whether the process is inside or outside of the organism. How would you treat it then? So it's really his concept here is to try to encourage people to be open-minded and not kind of biased in a knee-jerk way, biased in an immediate way against the idea of extended cognition. This principle is at work in one of Clark and Chalmers' other leading examples, the one they begin their paper with, the example of a hypothetical implant that allows a human to perform a kind of mental rotation that humans can't perform with their biological resources alone, but that has precisely the same computational profile as the process of using a keyboard to rotate an image on a monitor. So you're meant to imagine or remember, if this is something you've done, playing a game where, say, you use the arrow keys on your computer keyboard to rotate some image on the screen to change the perspective on a game piece or on a scene. This is something we can kind of do with our biological resources. We can perform some acts of mental imagery, but using the actual computer and the keyboard to rotate an image on the screen, it has a different computational profile than the one in our brains, the process of imagining has in the brain. So Clark and Chalmers are not going to anchor their judgment about the use of an image on your computer monitor. They're not going to anchor that to what does in fact happen in the brain. Clark and Chalmers claim that such a device would be thought of as cognitive if it were implanted in the brain. If you could create a chip that it was sort of a little miniature computer and you could rotated images on a screen and you could implant that in the brain, and the information from those rotations could be delivered to other parts of the brain, we would consider that cognitive, they say. Now, given that the chip implanted precisely mimics what happens when we use a keyboard to rotate objects on the monitor, say when solving a problem quickly in a video game, the parity principle entails that such everyday use of the keyboard and monitor to solve problems is genuinely cognitive. If it were, you know, shrunk down and stuck into a chip and stuck into the brain, it would be cognitive. So while it's out in the world, it's cognitive as well, Clark and Chalmers say, part of your cognitive process. It is not required that the external resource have the same functional profile as an existing internal resource, only that its profile be the same as something that would be treated as cognitive if it were in the head. By the parity principle then, because the chip would be cognitive if it were in the head, the external process of using the keyboard and monitor is also cognitive. Okay, I want to move now to an evaluation of these arguments. And I don't mean to do this sort of piecemeal, setting up the arguments and then picking at them. I'm going through these arguments partly because they're so influential. And so it's important to engage with them if one disagrees with the conclusions. But also I wanted to go through them because I think it reveals something deep about what we should be looking for in philosophy of cognitive science if we want to understand cognition, which I'll begin talking about today, but will also carry us through tomorrow's lecture as well. A search for a kind of theory of cognition itself. In fact, Wednesday we'll proceed with this at the group level. So we'll be trying to solve this underlying theoretical problem for a couple of days. My overarching concern about the arguments is that they're insufficiently grounded in cognitive science. Judgments about cases are driven by certain similarities. But why should we think the content of those intuitive judgments reflects the actual nature of cognition? Why should we think those intuitive judgments track the relevant similarities? We cannot, for example, make precise or meaningful comparisons of the inner to the outer without having in hand a theory of cognition to guide the comparison. The idea is that when Clark and Chalmers say that some external process, say shuffling the Scrabble tiles around, they say that it plays the same role as what might be happening internally. It plays the same role as what is happening internally. They can't mean literally the same role. They don't have all the same properties. The Scrabble tiles are made of wood and they have letters carved into them and then filled in with ink. There are all kinds of properties that the Scrabble tiles and the rack have that the internal process doesn't have. So what Clark and Chalmers are saying is that they share the relevant properties, the ones that are relevant to cognition. But that presupposes we know which properties are relevant to cognition. We might be suspicious about that. Similarly, we cannot trust what we think we would say about hypothetical cases of putting things inside people's heads without a well-supported theory of cognition. It's especially important. I think the concerns I just expressed become especially pointed when we start thinking about differences between the external and the internal materials. So let's begin thinking about what the folk would say and kind of see why the scientific work would be so important. The extended mind concerns our everyday intuitions and thoughts about human cognition, human mind, human consciousness. The external states and processes in question differ in many ways from internal ones. In the case of our everyday categories, such as memory and belief, the differences are important, very important from the everyday standpoint, from the standpoint of the average person not doing science. For example, it sounds ridiculous to the everyday person to say that you literally sat on top of your beliefs or that you literally forgot your memories on the bus. If external storage is possible, in the way Clark and Chalmers are saying, if your memories or your beliefs could be stored in a notebook, say, then you could sit on top of your memories, or you could leave your memories on the bus. You could kick your memories. You could spit on your memories. Now, such language might sometimes be used metaphorically in the context of fiction or poetry, but the idea that one would literally sit on them, I think at the very least would strike the average speaker as semantically deviant. It's the kind of sentence that would get a star in the linguistics literature. Now, these everyday intuitions might evolve in response to scientific progress. That sometimes happens. But that would require scientific support for an extended view. As things stand, however, folk intuition seems to treat the differences between an internal memory and a supposedly external one to be very important. So, the folk seem to be against extended mind. To the extent that they would change their mind, it requires that we return to the science, maybe, and provide, good interpretation of the science that would tutor folk intuitions and revise them. So let's think more about cognition then. The properties of interest in successful research programs in cognitive science tend to be fairly fine-grained, such things as the number and decay rate of stimulus items held in short-term memory. Other properties include, say, interference, recency effect, various in the domain of memory, there are all sorts of documented effects to do with the how the order of the learning of items on a list affects one's retention of those items. These are fairly specific or fine-grained properties of the process. And in some cases, these differences between internal and external resources are so great in terms of their, fine-grained properties, that the use of external resources would change the output's profile drastically. Imagine participants in a conversation attempting to use external resources, say a notepad, to maintain a running model of the discourse during conversation. The result would be quite different from a normal conversation. It's an amazing feat of human memory that in a conversation, we can kind of keep track of what's been said so far, adjust the model as more contributions are made, sort of build upon what's been said. And we do it all very quickly in real time, speaking back and forth to each other. The idea that you know, one could do this by writing things down is not far-fetched, but it would certainly change the explananda. What you get a different conversation with regard to the dynamics that linguists and discourse analysts are normally interested in. This suggests that appealing to similarities between external processes and existing internal ones won't serve Clark and Chalmers well as an argument from cognitive science. That is, they'll run into lots of differences between the internal and the external, which will backfire on them. Now, one thing that, one strategy that has often been suggested is to kind of think not so much about fine-grained kinds, but to think about generic kinds. Clark and Chalmers have tended to fall back on the idea of generic kinds or coarse-grained functional roles, roles that are defined so broadly that they easily encompass wholly internal states, wholly external states, and states that are a mixture of the two. They're something like umbrellas that bring in lots of states. The idea is that even though extended cognitive processes differ from internal ones in ways of importance to cognitive science, the external processes are still cognitive in a very broad sense. They're simply a different species of cognition. External memories are not memories of the same specific type as biologically encoded memories. They still count as memory, however, just a different kind of memory. In which case, there must be some generic kinds, the memory broadly construed that both internal and external memories are instances of. There has to be an overarching natural kind that collects these together in a substantive way. And this raises the question of the scientific utility of generic kinds, because skepticism abounds among scientists and philosophers about a wide variety of generic kinds, on grounds that have nothing to do with the debate over extended cognition, just on independent grounds. Significant challenges have been raised in the cases of concepts, like whether the idea of a concept, a very broad idea, is really valuable. Emotion, memory, cognition. Another is meaning, whether there really is such a thing as meaning, full stop, or whether we simply have these more specific processes of cognitive structures that you might think of as kinds of meaning, but that itself would be misleading because there's no single thing they all share of any importance. The worry is that these kinds seem too thin to do much work all on their own. So either they aren't relevant at all, or they don't do enough scientific work to support claims to revolution in cognitive science. I'm not saying it would be useless to have an overarching notion of memory. It may be good for organizational purposes. Some years back, I went to International Conference on Memory, ICOM. I was at a university in the UK and talked a little bit about extended mind. And there were hundreds of talks. It was a huge conference, 4 days, sessions running all over. No one at that conference talked about memory simpliciter, just memory, full stop. Everyone talked about specific kinds of memory in specific contexts, procedural memory in the context of dance, learning to dance, and so on and so forth, cognitive neuroscience of working memory. And so it made it seem as if the notion of memory was merely an organizational tool to bring all these people together, not that there was a single phenomenon that was being studied that is the object or focus of discussion in cognitive neuroscience or cognitive psychology. The thing shared by, for example, internal and external memories is that they represent information available to the subject. That seems to be, if you tried to identify something that's common to the cases, that seems to be the common thread. Excuse me. But that category alone isn't of much interest in cognitive science. That is, the bare difference between merely having access to some information, say in the library near your house, and not having it at all isn't a difference explored much in the cognitive sciences. Don't get me wrong, on many experiments, the error rates are very important. You know, how accurate was the subject's categorization of the stimuli on the computer monitor? But the variable sort of was information somewhere in the environment or in the brain or anywhere available, or was it simply lacking, is not a variable that shows up much in cognitive scientific modeling. In the case of memory, many memory scientists themselves have abandoned the idea that there's a single kind, memory, shared by all the various internal processes and states that are sometimes called memory. I think Fergus Craik is one of the major figures who would fall into this category. So I'm not confident that the move to generic kinds will work. In fact, I suspect it won't be helpful to Clark and Chalmers. It doesn't really reflect what's going on in cognitive science, at least at the in the domain of cognition. It doesn't seem to get them much mileage. There are also some problems with the parity principle. The fundamental argumentative strategy of appealing to the parity principle seems pretty risky, or at least it begs the question. It presupposes a correct theory of cognition rather than helping us find one. So remember, the counterfactual in question is, would I treat that external process as cognitive if it were inside the head? But this counterfactual question is difficult to evaluate in many cases. If the use of a notebook were happening inside my head, would it be considered cognitive? Well, no, if you take that question literally, because I would be dead if there were a notebook inside my head. There would be no cognition at all. Imagine that you took a notebook and you stuck it inside my brain. That would be so destructive. It would severely disable me, possibly kill me. And similarly, many people have talked about like visual processing as an extended process. So as I come up to a building and I round the corner of the building, my body is interacting with the building during the visual process. Is the building part of my cognitive process? If you use the parity principle, you get an even clearer death-inducing result. If the building were inside of my head, I would most surely be dead. More problems with the parity principle. So Clark and Chalmers can appeal to this kind of counterfactual only in cases like that of microchips. So if anything, the parity principle provides a limited argumentative device. Of course, you go back to some things I suggested earlier. They can appeal to the parity principle in the case of notebooks or Scrabble tiles, so long as they presuppose they know which of the properties of these objects are cognitive. But then that defeats the whole purpose of the test. If you already know which properties are cognitive, you don't need to ask whether the object, if it were in the head, would be considered cognitive. Clark and Chalmers seem to have a general application in mind, most likely because they assume that we already know what cognition is, that we know which properties must be preserved when we consider putting an external process into the head. But we wouldn't need to be doing philosophy of cognitive science to figure out where cognition is if we already knew what was cognitive and what was not. We can't assume that we know which properties are the cognition relevant ones. Cognition is a scientific posit, and we must do the science to figure out which similarities and differences among states are relevant to their status as being cognitive. We must do the science, and we must do the philosophy of cognitive science. We have to reflect on patterns in the experimental results and theoretical modeling. The parity principle provides a reliable way to identify external cognitive states only if change in the location of a state and process from outside the organism to inside the organism doesn't change the status of the state or process in question. But it's not clear that location doesn't matter. So now I'm homing in on a specific property and asking, here's a property that's central to the reasoning process. The location of the object, inside the head or outside the head. And then saying, you know, how do we know that doesn't matter? That could very well be one of those properties that is important to cognition, in which case a state might be cognitive inside the head, but not outside, because location matters. It's, you know, Clark, as I described Clark's strategy earlier, he wants to create this veil of metabolic ignorance. He wants to put the reader in a position where they are not attending to location. They're being neutral or open-minded about location. But there's a certain bias built into that itself. This is an assumption that we know that location doesn't matter, or we shouldn't think that location matters. But there are other examples. This is just meant to be from biology, not necessarily from cognitive science. Just consider a neural example. If I observe a neuron in preparation in a petri dish, say, and I'm asked, if that neuron were in your head, would it be participating in large-scale neurodynamics? I might well say yes, because in the most likely scenario in which that neuron is in my head, it's because it's part of my brain. Right? Someone says, imagine that neuron's in your head, right? What would I do? I'd probably be like sticking it into part of my brain. And so if it were in my head, it would be participating in large-scale neurodynamics. But that does not entail that the neuron is participating in large-scale neurodynamics when it's in the petri dish. It's just sitting there alone in a bath, in a nutrient bath, maybe pulsing. So even if I think the neuron would be participating in large-scale neurodynamics if it were in my head, it is, there should be a not in there, my apologies. It is not doing so when it's in an external location. This appears to be a counterexample to the parity principle then. My apologies, do make a note of that if you can. It is not doing so when it's in an external location. So this appears to be a counterexample to the parity principle. Moreover, it's possible that being cognitive is similarly a kind of relational, holistic, or systems level property. In order to decide that issue, we have to examine the science. And I don't want to give the impression that this is only a matter of what happens in neuroscience or cognitive science. You know, consider a very different example. Someone is in a field in England, and they're firing a gun in that field. They have a rifle and they're shooting it, right? Does that count as a military action? Well, it depends on relational, holistic, or systems level properties. At the level of kind of political science, I guess, whether England has declared war on another country or whether another country has declared war on England and whether there's a battle in the vicinity. It depends on what's happening around this person. If the person has just walked out into a field and there's no geopolitical context of war, then shooting the gun is not a military action. But precisely the same behavior, exact same person, exact same gun, exact same finger pulling, that would count as an act of war put in a different context. So the idea is that, you know, generally speaking, throughout the social sciences and physical sciences, many properties are relational. Being a planet is relational in a way. The very same chunk of material hurtling through space counts as a planet when it's in the orbit of a star, but it counts as something else, an asteroid maybe, if it's not in orbit, if it's just sailing through space. But for at least certain range of time, the trajectory could be identical across the two cases. You know, putting things in different places can actually change their status scientifically. It really stacks the deck for Clark to try to get us to see location as irrelevant without establishing that cognition is location irrelevant. We have to figure out first whether cognition is one of these relational, holistic, or systems level properties. I think it is, but I'll have to work up to that characterization of cognitive systems. So I want to reframe the inquiry in a way, starting with a methodological assumption. The cognitive processing is whatever kind of activity distinctively explains intelligent behavior. Now, that's pretty vague. But the idea there is, let's start with the explananda. They don't remain fixed. As a science develops, there can be a refining of the explananda phenomena, like observable phenomena that may have been thought earlier to be of a piece with each other, to go together in the same science, may end up getting separated and put into two different sciences, and so on. But having acknowledged the possibility of revision, this is the touchstone. We do want to model actual data in cognitive science. So abstraction from successful scientific investigation of intelligent behavior might then help us to resolve philosophical debates about the property being cognitive, and thus about the location of cognition. So let's look at intelligent behavior, look at successful explanations of it, and then examine, you know, how those theories or models work to see whether we can find a kind of distinction between what's cognitive and what's not. And a really neutral way to ask this is just to set to ask whether there's a principal distinction between two kinds of cause, such that the internal states and processes commonly thought to cause intelligent behavior are typically mostly of one of the two kinds, and a significant number of external contributors turn out also to be of that kind. And the idea, just elaborate a little bit on this first half of the slide. The idea might be to take the word cognitive out of the mix for now, take it out of the discussion. It's contentious. Many people think it's making a value judgment, and that somehow it expresses a kind of negative or nasty attitude towards the things that aren't cognitive. And I want to somehow neutralize that and say, look, here's the basic structure of the debate. Throughout history, everyone has recognized two kinds of cause to the contribution of intelligent behavior. Even those cognitive scientists who were using sort of models in computer science generated from the armchair to write chess playing programs, even they realized that if a human was involved, the chessboard is external. Part of what any player is responding to is a causal process that includes the chessboard, the perception of the position of the knight and the king and the rook, right? The perception of those positions is a causal interaction with the environment. So the set of causes that produce an intelligent behavior, say a movement of the rook from one position to another, that set of causes will include some that are internal and some that are external. Now, it has historically been thought that some of those causes are of a different kind than others. Cognitive is the label we'd give them, but let's set the label aside for a moment and say, okay, there's one kind of cause that historically has been thought to appear mostly inside the head. And we can understand Clark and Chalmers' thesis as saying, yes, true, and many of the things that appeared outside the head, those causes of the other kind, well, they weren't really causes of the other kind. They were causes of the first kind, the kind that we were putting the causes inside the head into. So thinking that way, it's a bit convoluted and it tortures the language a bit, but it does suggest a kind of strategy to find a distinction of central importance that runs through cognitive science between two kinds of causes, I should say, that could divide the causal contributors to the production of intelligent behavior into two fundamental categories. Then ask where those two kinds of causes appear. So looking for the distinction does not beg the question. It does not presuppose that location matters or that we'll find causes of one kind inside the head and causes of the other kind outside the head. It just says, you know, go and look for a consistent distinction in cognitive science between two kinds of causes. And the place to look, I would claim, is at models and modeling. Modeling is the most commonly used tool in the sciences, cognitive sciences included. A model comprises abstract entities and their properties and specifies relations they bear to each other and to the measurable properties of target systems. One kind of model that is most clearly abstract is a set of equations, a single equation, but often a system of equations. The equations define relationships between, you know, mass and force, for example, in Newton's second law. Force equals mass times acceleration. Now, some philosophers of science in recent years have been emphasizing the utility of concrete models. You build a scale model of a city, and you can use that scale model to reason about the city. But even there, I think what the reason that model, that physical scale model is useful is because the parts of the model have properties related in certain ways that can be mapped onto the measurable properties of the target system, to the real city. So successful modeling predicts or explains behavior of a target system on the assumption that the system has concrete parts with properties related to each other in the ways in which at least some elements in the model relate to each other. Now, cognitive modeling seems to have a common thread. All successful forms of cognitive modeling, whether they're computational or connectionist or subsumption-based, that's a reference to Rodney Brooks's robot building research program, was getting a lot of press for a while. So whether they're computational or connectionist or subsumption-based or dynamical systems-based or brute neural modeling, they all posit a set of persisting elements and their interactions that, as a whole, govern the production of intelligent behavior, partly by managing ongoing responses to the stream of changing environmental conditions. So here, maybe the word govern is a little bit too strong, but they manage is more like it. Much of what the internal machinery, I don't necessarily mean internal to the organism, but internal to the set of persisting elements and interactions, that relatively persisting set has to manage the recruitment and the deployment of external resources. Even if those external resources become very important, something is sort of helping to sort of determine when external resources get picked up and when they get dropped and the way in which they're interacted with. So that's one of the things the persisting set of elements does. That's an important one, but I don't want to make it seem as if that's all that the persisting system or persisting architecture does. It's also just mere kind of integrated persisting nature that distinguishes it from the external or other causes, system external causes. Thus, if there is a single dividing line of central importance in cognitive scientific models, it runs between the elements of what we might call the persisting architecture and the other causal contributors to the production of intelligent behavior. You know, the characterization of this can be very different. You know, a computational theorist might talk about the set of memory registers and the amount of random access memory that central processing unit has access to, you know, the binary code that's used to encode different bits of information. You know, that might be part of the computational description of the architecture. The connectionist description will be very different. It will say there are three layers of artificial neurons in this neural network. The input layer is fully connected to the hidden layer, and the hidden layer is partially connected to the output layer. And there are these activation functions that each of the units has, and so on and so forth. And on through the different examples that I have listed at the top of the slide, each of these approaches will characterize the set of integrated persisting resources differently, But the fact is, in their models, there will always be this distinction between a set of integrated, relatively persisting resources on the one hand, and other causal contributors on the other, right? A kind of passing parade of causal contributors. Right? And this seems to be, like, from a conceptual or theoretical standpoint, the single dividing line of central importance in cognitive scientific models. So we can approach this as an inference to the best explanation. That's what IBE stands for at the slide title. Right? Think of this as an inference to the best available explanation. If it were the case that a persisting architecture is the distinctively cognitive entity that would best explain, given current knowledge, why all different forms of successful modeling appeal to it. It's no accident that whether you're constructing a subsumption-based architecture, or a dynamical systems-based architecture, or a computational architecture, or a connectionist architecture, it's no coincidence that regardless of which of those kinds of modeling approach you're taking, you end up building an architecture into the model. Because, you know, that's what works. All four or five of those research programs have had success, significant success. And isn't that a coincidence that they all include the same kind of element, this complex element of persisting architecture? Well, that's given current knowledge, we should treat the boundary of the persisting architecture as the boundary of the cognitive system. That is, as the boundary between the causes that fall into one category and those that fall into the other category, regardless of what we call these categories. This seems to be the only clear, empirically and theoretically motivated distinction between what is distinctively cognitive and what merely causally contributes to the production of intelligent behavior. Now, to really demonstrate that jump there to the final bit of the slide, you have to consider alternatives. I say this seems to be the only clear empirically and theoretically motivated distinction. It's certainly more clear and better motivated than the use of the parity principle. The parity principle presupposes that one already kind of knows what's cognitive and what's not, which properties are relevant to cognition and which aren't, which properties should be preserved when we put something inside the head, hypothetically, right? So I think this approach beats the parity principle hands down as a guide to what's cognitive. But there may be other, you know, other things worth considering. We may have time to get to some of those today. We'll see. So you know, I don't want to claim that I've here surveyed every, you know, possible alternative, but this one sure emerges as a clear, empirically and theoretically motivated approach relative to others that have been considered in the extended cognition literature. All right, so here's a proposal then. This is a systems-based demarcation criterion. A state is cognitive only if it is the state of a mechanism that is a component of the cognitive architecture, broadly speaking, that is, of the relatively persisting collection of mechanisms that co-contribute in overlapping subsets to the production of a wide variety of forms of intelligent behavior. So I've taken this idea of a cognitive architecture, argued in favor of it, but I'm adding a bit here, and this is based to a great extent on what kind of more specific things I see in the models. When we move from models of individual types of behavior, when we move closer to what's known as a whole agent model, when we actually try to produce an intelligent system or model a wide range of forms of human behavior, then we wind up with a persisting collection of mechanisms that co-contribute in overlapping subsets to the production of a wide variety of forms of intelligent behavior. I really want to emphasize this because often, very, very often, models of behavior are focused on a particular data set or a small family of data sets And so, you know, they're all models of decision-making, or they're all models of categorization, or they're all models of sentence processing. And so they tend to, you know, be really pared away. There's the model isn't meant to explain, you know, gameplay, like playing Scrabble, for example, right? And so it's limited to only the data that's being considered. But one of the things that's so striking about human intelligence is the ability to perform a wide range of tasks and to switch from one task to another. And so that is part of the very explananda, it's part of the explananda in cognitive science, which we'll talk a bit more about tomorrow when we talk more about cognitive systems and my positive characterization of them. But I, you know, I'm trying to acknowledge and motivate right now the addition of the bit on the slide, co-contribute in overlapping subsets to a production of wide variety of forms of intelligent behavior. Where did that come from? I've been trying to explain that. Notice too that the criterion is put as a necessary condition, a cognitive state. A state is cognitive only if it is, et cetera. It could be if and only if, that maybe that is correct, right? To make this a biconditional, a kind of equivalence. But all that's required in an argument with the proponents of extended cognition is what's on the screen. A state is cognitive only if it's a state of the cognitive system. If it turns out that the cognitive system is inside the skin, then there can be no cognitive states beyond the skin. And that result, that kind of negative result, will be secured by this weaker principle, this principle that's weaker than an equivalence. It's strong enough to do that particular job, but it may be the correct view of cognitive systems. I think what I want to leave open, like, well, this sounds a little bit cagey on my part or a little bit too careful. But what I want to leave open is the possibility that cognition may require something else. It's not just that it's a cognitive system, but maybe it's only the parts of the system that are representational, or, you know, put in something else. So there may be an additional condition on cognition. It doesn't merely need to be part of the cognitive system, but it also has to, and then, you know, fill in the blank with something additional. I'm not trying to fill in that blank. I just want to leave that possibility open. So where are human cognitive systems? That was part of the question, you know, that needs to be addressed if we're going to bring the discussion of cognitive systems into contact with the literature on extended cognition. Well, the extent of the success of orthodox cognitive science gives us reason to believe that there is an integrated, persisting cognitive system inside the organism. There's, as you might say, at least one in there. But I will argue there's no sufficiently strong reason to posit any further cognitive systems that include the human as a part. Doing so would violate canons of theory choice in the sciences, such as simplicity and conservatism. I will emphasize simplicity today. Given that cognition occurs only within a cognitive system, then heck is false, this schematic argument. The idea is not to beg the question and just assume the success of kind of historical cognitive science, right? It's rather to appeal to that success to establish that there's at least one, you know, full-on cognitive system inside the skin. So there's at least one. And then the second premise argues, or it asserts that there's at most one, there aren't any others, right? And so that requires additional argumentation. And it says, why shouldn't we go beyond the tradition? Even if the tradition has been successful and established that there is at least one cognitive system inside the skin of the organism, why shouldn't we go on and posit more cognitive systems, or a shrinking and a growing cognitive system or something like that? All right, in support of the first premise that orthodox cognitive science establishes the existence of at least one cognitive system inside the skin, Many successful research programs in cognitive psychology, cognitive science more broadly, investigate subjects' exercise of the same cognitive capacities under various conditions. Also, in developmental psychology, many successful research programs track the changes of a subject's cognitive capacity over time. So, sort of gradual differences in the set of persisting resources, which is an interesting subject here because we're talking about relative rates of change. But let's stick with the first kind of example. The false belief task, and then we could talk about development as well later, but think it simple. Just think of the same capacity being exercised under different conditions. Right? So young subjects observe a vignette with two characters. One character, Sally, puts a marble into a basket, while a second character, Anne, watches. Sally then leaves the room. While Sally is out of the room, and moves the marble to a different location, to a box. Then Sally returns to the room. Okay, so you get this, these are 3 and 4 year olds. They might be watching a puppet show. They might just have a little story read to them about this, but you have these two characters, Sally and Anne, and they're both hanging around together. Sally puts a marble into a basket and while Anne watches. And then Sally says, I'm going to go outside and play. And Sally leaves the room. And while Sally's out of the room, Anne kind of sneaks over and takes the marble and moves it to a different location, to her box. Then Sally returns to the room. The subjects are asked, where will Sally look for her marble? Until about age 4, subjects say, in the box. After that, they give the correct answer, in the basket. Why is in the basket the correct answer? Well, because that's the last place that Sally saw it, and she doesn't know that Anne moved it. But prior to at age 4, subjects don't seem to understand that Sally maintained her belief while she was gone, and now has a false belief, one that has been made false in her absence, about the location of the marble. Joseph Perner was the first person to demonstrate this effect. He used a puppet show with pieces of chocolate being hidden in a drawer or a cabinet, but same idea. It's come to be known as the false belief task. It's been run hundreds and hundreds of times, maybe into the thousands by now. Now, one thing to note about this task is the consistency within an age group. So that's the first of the 2 points I was emphasizing on the previous slide. There's consistent behavior among the 3-year-olds and consistent behavior among the 5-year-olds. Right? But there's also this consistent developmental trajectory that I was mentioning on the previous slide as well, that you consistently see the subject's capacities change in this regular way over time. Now, these are robust results. Results on the false belief task appear regardless of whether the task is administered using puppets, pictures, live action, narrative, video. Doesn't matter what sort of materials the task is presented using. Similarly, it doesn't much matter what questions are asked. The researchers have tried asking the question in lots of different ways. You can get slightly different shifts, that is the timing of the shift can be pushed around a little bit depending on how the task is presented. But the developmental trajectory is the same for kids who don't understand false belief. You know, it doesn't magically appear at birth if you just ask the question the right way. But the question has been asked lots of different ways verbally. For example, you know, well, if her brother comes in, where will Sally tell her brother to look for the marble, right? She'll tell him to look for the marble in the basket is the right answer because that's the last place Sally saw it. So, you know, you can try to probe the child's understanding of false belief, how the child is representing Sally's mind in different ways, but you get similar results, similar patterns of results. So the materials do not seem to be part of the system that solves the problem. What is consistent across the cases is the organism. Similar remarks apply to correlations between subjects' ability to comprehend narrative across different kinds of materials. This is a just a kind of side point, but just to make the point that there's nothing special here about the false belief task. It's not a sort of amazing singular success in the history of cognitive psychology, in this case, developmental psychology. It's rather, it's par for the course. So you see a similar kind of result if you look at adults or young adults, high school age kids, whatever, ability to comprehend narrative across different kinds of material. There's a correlation between a subject's ability to comprehend a spoken narrative, a visually presented narrative, which is in a movie, a narrative that's been presented in text they read, a narrative that's presented in text that's read to them, right? Here are some references. Wellman, Cross, and Watson, 20 years ago now, did a meta-analysis of theory of mind development. At that time, I think they had around 1,000 experiments, the truth about false belief. And with regard to narrative, if you're interested in that particular topic, I've also included a reference, Watching the Brain Comprehend Discourse, work by Morten Gernsbacher, is one of the important figures here. I want to make, I guess, one side remark. There's been a big controversy about whether the false belief task is the litmus test for having a theory of mind. I didn't mean to wade into that controversy in any way. I'm not saying that passing the false belief test is that time when the child then understands other minds. I'm not invested in that at all. I just want to make this point about the variation in materials versus the consistency of the organism. And the consistency of the organism is producing consistent results despite variation in materials. It's also producing a consistent sameness of organism across time is producing sameness of developmental trajectory across subjects, regardless of the various materials they have with them or don't have with them. So for the same capacity to be exercised at different times, the same subject of that capacity or of the underlying cognitive states must be present at each of those times. And I'm not using capacity or subject in any really robust metaphysical way here, just saying, you know, for the same pattern of activity to be displayed at different times, the same materials that produce that pattern of activity must be present at each of those times. In the cases under consideration, the extended system consisting of the organism and the external materials interacted with does not persist for a sufficient length of time. It's not there on the various experimental occasions because the materials are swapped out or switched for something else. Thus, extended systems are not the subjects of the capacities or states in question. And this, you know, this is simply obvious in lots and lots of cases. When a subject studies for an exam, they have the text available. They read the story, they read Shakespeare or whatever, and they read it again and they learn about the characters, and then they have to set all that aside and go take the exam. Now, they might take the exam on multiple occasions. They might sometimes be allowed to use the book while they're taking the exam, but sometimes the book's not there. And you see consistency in scores across these situations. And why would that be if there is no internal system, cognitive system, capable of generating intelligent behavior? The system doesn't fall apart when those tools are taken away, the specific tools. But why not allow further cognitive systems? So I've supported premise one in my earlier argument. There's at least this one cognitive system inside the human organism. Why not allow some further cognitive systems? Notice that all parties to the debate are already committed to organisms that contain a cognitive system. And on the assumption that I was right over the last few slides, I've established that there's at least one inside the cognitive, inside the organism. They're also committed to detailed explanations of how organismic states interact with external states. Even those who, you know, believe in extended cognition are often really invested in telling the story about how the organism interacts with the environment to create what they call a new cognitive system. So they need the interface. Everybody needs the interface. Everybody needs the internal cognitive system, and they need the interface, which then produces the behavior typically of just an organismic system, not of a wider system. Well, that's really the first two points that are really important. Under these conditions, there doesn't seem to be any motivation for adding more cognitive systems. One can combine all of the materials from the previous slide, you know, the internal cognitive system, the external materials, all the details of the interface, and you could posit a host of new, often short-lived cognitive systems. Right? You could do that, but that would violate the methodological canon of simplicity by adding another system without, well, many other systems, without any empirical motivation. It would be to multiply entities beyond necessity. I, as the skeptic about extended cognition, will say, okay, everybody's got this internal cognitive system. We're all committed to this on the basis of the data and the modeling. Okay? Now, we all know that cognition is highly interactive. Materials from the environment contribute to the process of producing intelligent behavior. So we've got that bit. Now, that tells the whole story. Now we have a complete explanation of the intelligent behavior. The proponent of the extended view says, yes, all those materials are included, but I want to put them all together and call them a new cognitive system and posit a new entity. That new entity is, from the standpoint of what's often called Occam's razor, a violation of simplicity. There's simply no empirical motivation for tacking that on to increasing our ontological commitments. So let's think for a moment about what I've called HEMC, or H-E-M-C, as an alternative to HEC. The hypothesis of embedded cognition, HEMC, is as follows. The human mind does not extend beyond the boundary of the organism, but human cognitive processing depends in surprising ways and to a surprisingly great extent on the environment in which the human is located. The cognitive system does its work in a surprisingly interactive way, utilizing a wide range of tools and types of scaffolding in the environment. This is, in my original article on this material, that is the first one I published in 2004, I present this as an alternative to HEC. But I, you know, make it clear that this is drawing on a tradition that was not necessarily related to the debate over extended cognition, or the idea that the mind extends, but it's a rich tradition going back to Herb Simon, Gerd Gigerens, or many other folks along the way saying that cognition is, you know, sort of dependent in some way on the structure of the environment. It's locally valid. Or it's a process of satisficing, Simon used to say. He coined the term bounded cognition. It's kind of making the best of problem solving as best we can, given the limited resources we have. So I just want to flag that, you know, I'm not claiming necessarily originality for this. But in this context, here's a way of putting some of the ideas in a nutshell as an alternative to HEC. Some of the subtheses are that the cognitive system explicitly represents less information than has often been thought. Subjects often do not store detailed facts about the environment, but instead acquire information from the environment as needed. So this, when I say detailed facts, this would include an elaborate theory. Subjects don't necessarily have an elaborate theory about the environment. Subjects typically rely on shortcuts and heuristics. That language might be familiar from the literature by, say, Dan Kahneman, the heuristics and biases literature from Tversky and Kahneman. So subjects typically rely on shortcuts and heuristics that are locally effective, but which, if formulated as beliefs, would be false. So an example here. You're buying a car. You follow the principle, choose the first car that meets some minimum standard of perceived quality while not exceeding a maximum cost. I should say socially perceived quality is what I had in mind. This strategy works well enough in an environment where a car is being widely perceived as well-made, is strongly correlated with its providing reliable transportation. in that case, you could just, you say, oh, well, this BMW is a popular car. I can afford it. I'll buy a BMW. And the process is reduced to a simple, quick rule, guideline. The subject does not need to represent detailed information about many kinds of cars. The subject need not have a detailed theory of automobile mechanics, performance, or production. If people generally like cars of brand X, those cars are reliable, maybe literally false as a universal generalization. But in a cooperative environment, it leads to satisfactory results. Maybe not optimal results, but this is part of the message of this history of thinking about cognition as bounded, satisfying, that calculating optimality is burdensome, that doing a full cost-benefit analysis is, it sounds great when you're thinking in the abstract about the ideally rational agent in the economic marketplace. But in the real world, we have to make many decisions quickly with limited resources. And so we should be thinking about the way the environment helps to guide us, or our thinking can at least depend on the environment to sort of cooperate when we're making these decisions quickly without doing optimality analyses or full cost benefit analysis. Now, to finish the discussion today, I think this is probably as far as I'll get. I want to consider pragmatic considerations. Clark and others have sometimes appealed to the potential pragmatic value of adopting the extended perspective, really put a lot of emphasis on this, in fact. The idea being that we will make more scientific progress if we adopt tech. And this really speaks to that question of paradigm shift or revolution in cognitive science, the issue that I flagged early on in the lecture as the one I am interested in. Now, this approach is of potential interest, but it requires evidential support. And I'll argue that the historical record in cognitive science seems not to support Clark's claim. See, the pragmatic concern would be compelling, or the pragmatic argument would be compelling, were there actual cases in which the Heck-based perspective led to cognitive scientific advances, and where HEMC, the embedded perspective, had it been adopted in place of Heck, would have presented those advances, would have prevented them. And this seems to be what Clark is saying some of the time, that you have a great early work that was done in the 90s and on into 2000s that, you know, was inspired by the extended vision. So far as I can tell, though, the classic empirical research taken to support Heck was motivated not by a specific commitment to Heck, but rather by a general sense that interaction with the environment plays an important role in cognitive processing. Consider the work of Dana Ballard on vision. Consider the way Dana Ballard and colleagues described their project in one of the most influential empirical papers in the situated tradition. Their language sounds more like Hempke than Heck. They say, our central thesis is that intelligence has to relate to interactions with the physical world, meaning that the particular form of the human body is a vital constraint in delimiting many aspects of intelligent behavior. This is from Deictic Codes for the Embodiment of Cognition in Behavioral and Brain Sciences. And it one of the central results, which I move on to, I guess I should make sure this is clear what's on this slide. You know, they talk about interactions with the physical world. They talk about the human body as mediating these interactions. But really, they're pretty vague about where the cognition is, whether the cognition is in the body or not, and whether the cognition is in the external world. And when you look at the actual tasks that they are having their subjects complete, the tasks they're collecting data on, and the way they describe those tasks, they seem to have a pretty traditional inside the skin view of the cognitive process. Let me give you a quick, you know, sense of what this work is on. I've got a picture here of their blocks copying task. I won't try to go into detail about the little squiggles on the screen, but I'll give you some sense of what's going on there. So they provide subjects with a what's on the right, you see labeled resource, a resource pool of blocks. And they provide on the upper left a model that the subject is supposed to recreate or to copy in the lower left in the workspace. And we have eye tracking in place. So they actually, Ballard and College ran this the experiment with actual blocks like Lego blocks, building blocks, but they also ran the experiment on a computer screen. So you've got different kinds of gear being used, but in both cases, they're tracking the subject's eye movements during the blocks copying task. And a variety of strategies are being used. So that's important to recognize from the beginning. Sometimes proponents of extended cognition, I think, exaggerate a little bit the results. But one of the dominant strategies, especially early on in the problem-solving process, is very, you might say, light on working memory. It doesn't involve internal representation as much as one might expect. What do I mean here? Because in many of the cases, what subjects do, you can tell from the eye tracking, is that they look at the model to identify the color. They look over at the resource and they pick up a block. And then they look back at the model to identify the position. And then they look down at the workspace and then they put the block into the workspace. So you might think that an optimal use of resources would be to look at the model, see that I need a green, it will go on the bottom right. Get green, put it on the bottom right. They encode both sets of facts, reach over, pick up a green, and then go straight down and put the green in place. But instead, they go back and forth. First, they identify what color they need. They pick up the color, and then they go back and encode information about its location instead of encoding color and information simultaneously. Now, this is a, seems like a very small point, but a lot was made out of it. It was the idea that the external world is being relied on more for information as it's needed, as opposed to using a strategy of internal copying. But all of this requires, according to Ballard et al., that inside the skin, there are these deictic pointers. There are bits of visual processing that get bound to the color or get bound to the location, maybe at separate times rather than at once, but these different bits get bound to the location and then the color. And that information then is useful for motor control. It's not as if the world is making the arm move to a green block. It's the bit of information. Now, maybe it's a scanty bit, smaller than expected. It's just the color. And then the subject has to go back and get more information, or does in fact go back and get more information. But it's still the representation of the information that then is driving the setting of the block down in a particular location. All right, let's look at one other example. Kevin O'Regan did some of the early work on other work on visual processing. That inspired the extended view of cognition. It's highly cited. One of his heavily cited papers is Solving the Real Mysteries of Visual Perception, The World as an Outside Memory, 1992. Sounds very much like the extended mind, right? The world as an outside memory. So J. Kevin O'Regan sometimes describes visual processes in a way, though, that suggests embedded cognition, or HEMC. He claims that the visual system quickly collects information from the environment when the subject needs it, rather than maintaining a scale model of the surrounding environment. That sounds very heck. Encode less information than you might have thought. You know, people encode, don't build a full scale model, just, you know, represent as much information as is needed in the circumstance, right? Sounds like what he's saying. Okay, back to the quotation. apparently leaving intact the privileged status as the organism. Sorry, I get lost. This is not a direct quotation. I'm summarizing what he says. Apparently leaving intact the privileged status of the organism as cognitive processor. As O'Regan's title suggests, though, he sometimes advocates a version of Heck by proposing that the environment functions as part of the subject's memory. This suggests that the specific theoretical gloss he has in mind, whether it's Heck or Hemp, didn't matter much, right? If he can switch back and forth between the two, it seems like what really matters then is the shared aspect of the two. What Hemp and Heck have in common is their interactive emphasis. And it's the interactive emphasis that's making a difference, not whether we treat the external stuff as literally part of the cognitive system. So without that claim that the, you know, treating the external stuff as literally part of the cognitive system drives successful scientific work, without that claim, Clark's pragmatic motivation for adopting Heck seems to collapse. Now, there are other avenues for the support of Heck. I'll take 1 minute and give you one of the examples. One kind of approach has been developmental systems theory and biology. In developmental systems theory and biology, explanations of development sometimes treat internal and external resources symmetrically. And part of the idea here has been, say, Susan Oyama's attack on the privileging of genetic information, on the idea that the genes just encode a plan for development, rather than development is heavily epigenetic. It involves lots of interaction with the environment and resources that are just as important as for pushing things along, like hormones that are released into the nest by the mother in some animals that then provide some of the material for the development of the egg and the juvenile. So in that case, the proponents of extended cognition have argued sort of by analogy. But there are two points to make here, is that even in biology, there does need to be a distinction between the organism and what's beyond the organism. And this has been developed in some detail, like what makes an organism a coherent entity of its own. And that may be analogous to my development of an account of the cognitive system. But there's a broader point here, which is why associate biology and cognitive science? And this is a deep, persisting problem. And it came up a little bit last week when I talked about teleosemantics. There's a kind of this idea that somehow when we do cognitive science, we should adopt the perspective of biology. And I think cognitive scientists would do better simply to adopt the perspective of cognitive science. Biology might explain development by putting external and internal resources on par. I'm not sure it does, but even if it does, that doesn't really tell us whether cognition is kind of privileged as a process that occurs inside a cognitive system only. All right, I've gone over a couple of minutes. I better stop there.